I think you probably got my two emails of the last 24 hours about, well, three emails. There are three emails. One was that there were some problems with protist in the file package reading some of the protein files. Second one claimed I solved the problem. The third one said I didn't solve the problem, but 20 of the data sets work. I tried them. 7 didn't work. They need further tinkering by me. I have to re-download those, reformat them, and we'll get them all working. Any problems people are having, either computerological or conceptual, or I won't ask you for motivational problems, but although our board is covered with, you know, somebody obviously gave a motivational seminar or something in here. Anyway, issues, yes?
Do you think you will cover bootstrapping by Friday?
No.
Do you think we need to do that?
Did I tell you to do bootstrapping? We will cover it a little after that, and we will, in the third computer assignment, where you'll be doing maximum likelihood phylogenies, also ask you to bootstrap them. So you'll get a chance, unless you're like leaving Friday and will never come back, then that would be a problem. No, it doesn't go by Friday. Okay, so where we got to was going through the Jukes-Cantor model, the simplest possible model of DNA change, a stochastic model of change of nucleotides. And those events could be, you can think of them as mutational events, but if they're in the context of a whole population, they're really mutation followed by the substitution of the allele, although generally the population is being represented by a single sequenced haploid genotype. So we will be getting to that issue towards the end of the course and when we talk about coalescence. So you have to be a little bit careful that substitutions in a phylogeny where the individual sequences are just representatives of individuals in the population are not just, you can call them mutations, but you have to be a little careful. You could probably better just to call them substitutions, but that doesn't imply that the allele necessarily completely substituted in the population. You don't know that from these data, but anyway, you get that the expected differences per site, which turns out to be the what's statistically called the sufficient statistic, it's the only aspect of the data you have to look at to get a fully powerful estimate, go up, and as branch lengths gets larger, they rise towards 3/4. If you have it plotted this way, it's in a state where you could start from a value here, and by going through this formula, come out there. And so what you're estimating is a bigger number. It would be the same if it were on the dotted line. It's bigger, and it's bigger because it's reconstructing the changes that you didn't see, that were obscured because they were overlaid by subsequent change or reversed by subsequent change. So now why is it important to do that? And that's here we come to a very, very brief example, but it's an important point. If I have a true tree, this is an unrooted tree, and it's really just a sort of line going from A to C with B halfway along it, and if the branch lengths, this product of rate of change times time, are 0.20 and 0.20, with B on a zero length branch off to one side, it's basically sitting in between. And if I don't do that correction, if I just take the fraction of sites differing and say, that's distance, it's good enough, that's a so-called p distance, it's the naive distance, and I would indicate why it's not such a great idea. Because if I do that, and then I compute the observed distances. They won't be 0.20. They will be 0.1756 between A and B, and also between B and C. The distance between A and C, the fraction, will be 0.31. They don't add up. Now they really, if you consider the actual number of underlying events, they're supposed to add up. When you fit this, the least squares tree, let's say, to those distances, those uncorrected p-value distances, this is what you get. You get a perfect fit to those three numbers, but it's done by adding some branch length to the side. And the reason is that A and C look closer to each other than would be implied by going from A to B and then from B to C. And that causes the method to sort of push B off the line. What's happening basically is the underestimation of these long distances puts the tree under stress. The shorter distances are distorted. The tree is, the fit to the shorter distances is distorted by the pressure from these long distances that are too small because of the obscuring of changes by other changes. And you get this little war going on in a bigger, more complicated tree between trying to fit the big distances and trying to fit the little distances. And there's trouble. You can get all kinds of distortions in the tree. I should have probably made a more remarkable example. But you can get ones where the topology changes because the distances are so unhappy. But if you correct them, and if your correction is based on the correct model, that's an important point to underline. If the Jukes-Kander model is really what's going on and you do corrections, then you get back out exactly the correct tree. In this case, if you have enough sites that you can get good estimates of the fraction of differences and then go through this calculation that projects how many changes there were that you didn't see in addition, and uses that total. So there's a war between the long paths and the short paths in the tree, but with properly corrected distances, everything should work out in theory, in principle, if you've got the exactly correct model and if you've got enough sequence that you get a good estimate of the distances, please. It's not a simple matter. It gets a little simpler in a likelihood or Bayesian framework. You should, first of all, how do you do the corrections? In practice, you pick a distance in a program and it does it for you. Okay. So, but what it's doing is precisely this here. Okay, it's using the formula to go from the sufficient statistics to an estimate of branch length, which is between those two species, which is what a distance really is. As to whether you know you have the right model, first of all, you can look at the symmetries of the model and see if they actually seem to hold in the data. Under a Jukes-Kander model, all four bases are expected to be equally frequent in the DNA. And they usually aren't, so you need to use some more complicated model that allows bases to be unequally frequent. I'll be getting in a moment to other models that allow different frequencies of different bases and greater probability of a transition than of a transversion, of a change within the category of purines and within the category of pyrimidines than between them. As to how to make the decision, there isn't a really formal machinery for distance matrix methods. For likelihood and Bayesian methods, there is formal machinery in that you can fit the whole tree, including the models, and see which model gives you the best fit. And there's also a machinery that I won't have time to get to in the course, partly because I don't understand it very well myself, of model selection, and there are programs that will do that for you. We'll use things like the Akaika information criterion to try to decide which model is fitting your data best. So that's a somewhat superficial answer. Okay, so let me just mention some different distance methods, and then I think we're headed on to looking at some more approximate alternatives. I mentioned to you, I had been talking about least squares methods, and I mentioned weighted least squares methods. Fitch and Margoliash in 1967, in their very widely noticed paper, used a weighted method where the weight was the inverse of the square of the observed distance. This was just done to downweight the big distances, which are very noisy. The reason, I can give you an intuitive feel for why the big distances are noisy. There is some noise when you collect data just because you don't have an infinite number of sites in their estimation of the differences per site. A small noise here will result in a bigger noise here because of the slope of this curve. As you get out towards 3/4, a small noise here results in a very big change of the distances. So the big distances are much more uncertain than the small ones. They have more chance of just a random difference from what they're supposed to be because of this. And it's even true if you're near 0.75 in this Jukes-Kander scheme. Sampling can get you past 0.75, at which point the distance actually becomes infinite. And that's a worry. So big distances are very noisy. In the Fitch and Margoliash, they said, well, we think we can weight this. If we weight inversely by the square of the observed distance, you could also weight inversely by the square of the expected distance, but then that means the variables, the branch lengths that you're trying to estimate, are coming in both the numerator and the denominator. The whole thing becomes a nonlinear minimization and gets harder mathematically. This is pretty good. Cavalli-Schwarz and Edwards had used unweighted, so there's these differences in weighting, but they all come under the category of least squares methods. And you do them by searching trees, and then for each tree, you estimate its you estimate the branch lengths. Once you get a topology, you estimate the branch lengths by solving the right equations. And then you evaluate this thing and say, well, how good is that? How good a fit is that? There's a very nice literature on cuter, quicker ways of accomplishing the same thing by mathematical computational trickery that's basically speeding this up. And otherwise, for example, if you change a small part of the tree, you shouldn't have to redo all the calculations, and there are some ways to get around that. Yeah?
One question is, couldn't you estimate the variance given the number of sites you have and then use that to...
You could that? Use where I'm headed is exactly on that point. Let's see.
Oh, I could wait then.
Yeah, you could wait, but no, I'd have to go back. You're right. We did talk about this already. We talked about the fact that the optimal weight is actually the inverse of the variance. If you know the Jukes-Kander method, one can work out formulas for what that variance should be. That's a little more complicated than what either Fitch-Margoliash or Cavalli-Schwarz and Edwards did. Yes, it can be done. Yeah, so that wasn't getting ahead of us. That was actually going back. Okay, there are some other distance matrix methods you will see occasionally used. In fact, the most frequent method is coming up. I haven't told you about it yet. There's one called the minimum evolution method that was invented independently by two people, Kidd and Scaramella-Zondo in Cavalli Sforza's lab in 1971. And 21 years later, Rozhetsky and Ney reinvented it because they hadn't read that paper. And there they do a kind of weird thing. They go through the tree space, they get the trees, they estimate the branch lengths by least squares. And then you might think, okay, we're on our way, now all we have to do is evaluate that least squares quantity and see how good it is. But they don't do that. They evaluate the tree by another quantity, but by the sum of its branch lengths. This is called minimum evolution, which makes it sound like parsimony, but it's not at all parsimony method. It works fairly well. I'm not quite sure why. So it has a mixture of two optimization criteria, one to get the branch length and the other to evaluate the tree. You do see it used sometimes. It's not as widely used as the two methods that I'm going to come up to now, which are UPGMA and the neighbor joining method. Both of these do not have an optimization criterion. They can be argued to be related to some of those optimization criteria. They're clustering methods. They're methods of gradually building up a tree by putting things on. UPGMA is a clustering method, but then you're going to, in this case, interpret the result as a phylogeny. Neighbor joining is a clustering-like algorithm designed to infer a phylogeny. UPGMA is one that was invented in 1960, in the late 1950s by, I think, Robert Sokol, first published by Peter Sneath and by James Rolfe. It assumes implicitly that the tree is clock-like, so it's best, I'll show you in a moment by example, that it's going to fail to work properly if the tips are not about equally divergent from the root, which is the molecular clock. Now you may wonder about the name. Do people call it UPGMA? And the answer is no, they call it UPGMA. What is UPGMA? Well, what happened was that in Sokol and Sneath's book of 1963, they had a big classification of clustering methods, and they gave them letters. And this is the designation in their classification system of methods. It's the unweighted pair group mean agglomerative method. And nobody ever remembers that, so they just say UPGMA. So what is it? It's in a way the almost the simplest kind of clustering that you would develop. There's two ones that get invented again and again. The most invented one is called single linkage, and the next most invented one is UPGMA. And basically what it does is to say, you start out with giving each species a weight called 1, which is 1. You look at the distance table, you pick the smallest distance. You say to yourselves, okay, I'm going to combine those two things. You make a new group, which we'll call IJ. You then say, well, they're DIJ apart, so if there's a molecular clock, the lengths of branches down to where they join is half that, so that going down and then back up gets you UI, gets you DIJ. So you assign a time depth DIJ over 2 to their connection. Then you say, well, that group has two species in it, so we're gonna add up the weights. It'll have a weight of 2. WI plus WJ. Now comes the issue of, well, we've got a new thing, IJ, and the old two things, just I and J themselves, are going to be eliminated and replaced by this new thing. This new group is going to be a thing in the distance table. What is its distance to other species? Well, the answer will be, for each, you just take the distances of its members to that species. So if there's a species outside, you say, well, we'll take all the distances of the things that got combined in this group and we'll average them. So it's the simple average of their distances. And since when you do that, this weighting that we're doing works out. So in effect, it's weighting each species that is a member of a group equally. And the distance from this IJ thing to something out there called K is just the average of the distance of I to K and of J to K. Now, initially, we're talking about two individual species, so those are just two numbers. Later on in the process, those are going to be two groups that we combine, each with a different number of species. And if you want to preserve the equal weighting of contributions from of individual species, you're going to have to weight those Ds according to how many species there are in those two groups. So the distance you compute is a weighted average of the distance of I to K and the distance of J to K, weighted by how many species are being represented, are in the group I and the group J. Initially, for the first two you combine, it's just one in each. Now you delete the I and J rows and columns from the table, put in an extra row for IJ with these newly computed distances. Now you've got one fewer thing. Your distance table has shrunk by a row and a column, has had two columns and two rows eliminated and one new one put in. And you basically say, now we do it again. We look for the lowest distance in the table and we combine things. And we go back to step two and we do it again, and you just come back down again. You may say, well, I don't quite see that process. And this down here is just what I was telling you, is that this mysterious weighting here is just weighting each original species that got into a group equally. But the interesting thing you can do with this is do it. That is, this one can actually be carried out. I could go to the blackboard in the back and do the whole thing by hand. It would take us about 20 minutes, but this method is actually doable by hand, which is not true of most phylogeny methods. So let me show you a set of data and we'll do it. Here are 8 species: dog, bear, raccoon, weasel, seal and sea lion, cat and monkey. These are carnivores or their descendants. Seals and sea lions used to be in the old classification system, class Pinnipedia order Pinnipedia as opposed to order, the rest are in order Carnivora. But it's known that seal and sea lions, that pinnipeds actually evolved out of carnivores, and we'll see that on the tree that we get. We're using an outgroup, monkey. We're going to say, well, we're going to assume that Carnivora and Pinnipedia are together a monophyletic group, and we'll use the monkey, which is outside of them, a primate. This is probably a rhesus monkey. Vincent Sarich in 1969 in Berkeley was doing immunological distances, which is this very early method that doesn't even use protein sequences. It just uses immunological reactions, quantitative immunological reactions to proteins. And he got a table of immunological distances. There's a sort of exponential correction of them in there. He got an asymmetric table. What I've done is average them across the diagonal. So the two numbers here of bear reacting against raccoon or raccoon reacting against bear were different, but we average them, we get 26. So here's the whole table. First step, find the smallest number in the table, not counting the zeros on the diagonals. Anybody see the smallest number? 24, right? Right here. So I, let's see if I can move. There it is. Here are the two columns and the two rows between seal and sea lion. So now what we're going to do is take seal and sea lion and make an ancestor of those and have it be a distance down that is half of 24, so it'll be 12 down. And they're also, the distances to dog, bear, raccoon, and weasel of this new group will be gotten by averaging the two numbers. Let me go back. The numbers here were 50 and 48 to dog. Now these two are put into a single group. Its distance to dog is going to be 50 plus 48 over 2. And we'll be doing those averages. Sorry. And here is the first bit of tree. So we're working our way down from the tops. We tie together seal and sea lion at a depth of 12. Okay, so go back and look at the table. Here is, where is a, yeah, this is SS's seal sea lion. It has these distances that we've computed by doing the averages here. Now we look for the smallest number in the table, and that's bear and raccoon at 26. So we connect bear and raccoon at depth of 13, and we get the bear-raccoon averages. Now let me go back and show you. This is dog 40. If I go back, 32 and 48 to dog. If you average those, you get 40. 34 and 42 to weasel. If you average those, you'll get 38, and so on. So there they are, weasel to bear raccoon, bear raccoon to dog, and so on. They're the new, we've put in a new row BR and a new column BR. Okay. Now we look for the lowest number, 37.5 between bear raccoon and seal sea lion. We're tying those together. At what depth? Well, you have to work it out. It's 18.75 down, and you've already come 12 down here and 13 down there, so you figure out those branches. And you keep going. So now smallest value is between bear, raccoon, seal, sea lion, BRSS, and weasel. And you're going to do averages there and those columns. Notice the table's now getting pretty small. That brings in weasel at a depth of 19.75, and you need only a branch, a depth of one extra here to get down to 19.75. Here's the new table. Its smallest number is 45.8 to dog. Here comes dog at that depth. Now there's only cat and monkey. So down to three things. Smallest number, 89.833. There it is. And finally, now we're only two things left. The table has only one number in it, so there's no choice. 144.2857, so it's 72.14 depth here. And there's the UPGMA tree. And you'll see that if you had an old-fashioned hand calculator or a little calculator utility on your phone or something, you could do this. There aren't that many operations involved. So UPGMA is pretty fast. But its limitation is it assumes, it always makes a tree that has all the tips exactly equidistant from the root. That is fine if that's reality, not so fine if reality involves different rates of evolution from different lineages. Biologically, by the way, this is a pretty good tree, except that dog is too far, coming off too early. It really should come off, I believe, before bear raccoon split, but up in this branch, not this far down. So by enforcing a clock, when there might not have quite been clock-like evolution there, we've distorted the tree a little bit. But other than that, actually, this is biologically not bad at all. You may say, oh, these are carnivores, but these two are pinnipeds. Well, have you ever, gone down to Puget Sound and seen a seal swimming, and for a moment, its head comes up out of the water, and your brain goes, oh, is that a seal or a Newfoundland retriever?
Oh, yeah.
You look at the head, and very, very dog-like. And so that's for a good reason. They're related. Okay, so...
Can you explain a little more about the weighting?
The weighting, yes.
Really see how that comes
you're right,
into
I
this.
Should. Let me go back a ways to where we combine bear, raccoon, seal, sea lion, and weasel. So we're going to be combining those two. When we compute each of these numbers here, we want to compute the distance of this new group to dog. Now there are four species in here that have, this is an average of four species. This is just a single species. The weighting that we do puts a weight 4 on this and 1 on that. 4/5 on this and 1/5 on that. That is so that the distances to dog are the simple average of bear to dog, raccoon to dog, seal to dog, sea lion to dog, and weasel to dog.
Okay.
There is a method called WPGMA, which is unweighted and just does a simple average of those two, not used very often. You may notice that the terminology is reverse, that this unweighted paragroup method weights and the weighted paragroup method doesn't weight. And that's because it all depends on what you're counting as. The other one is unweighted in that it averages these two equally. But this method is weighted in that sense. It's weighted when it does that, but the result at a species level is being unweighted. That a group of three things has a distance to something else, a group of two things has a distance to something else. When you average those, you count equally by species, not equally by the two groups. So is that an answer to the does this approach an answer to the question?
It seemed though that when you were calculating the new distances for each of the groups, you were just averaging?
No, I wasn't.
No?
Because
okay.
If you look here, the average of these two, if I just go, it adds up to 95.5. The average, the unweighted average of these two would be 47.75, something like that. But let's look and see. We go ahead, and the table we get is not 47, it's 45.5, which when you go back here is much closer to this one than it is to that one because we did the weighting.
Great.
Okay, so we come, as we've gone along, yeah, I haven't shown you the exact weighting. Yeah, please.
I might already supposed to be knowing this, but does this method assume that, like, if you have two changes in, say, a protein sequence, they're independent of one another?
I missed a word, I'm sorry, Mike.
If you're comparing two protein sequences and calculating the distance, are you assuming that the changes, you have two changes, but they're happening independently?
In effect, yes. All the models of at the DNA per DNA change assume that bases are changing independently.
Okay.
And that may not be true, of course. And it's likewise, as we'll see, there are protein models. They make the same assumption about amino acid positions, that they assume they're happening independently. Now you may say, that's not realistic. And I'll say, fine, it isn't realistic. But I'm not going to pay any attention to that until you come back with a method that copes with that.
Right.
You know.
Well,
yeah.
He used immunological data to this, which is looking at a whole protein.
It's very.
There might have been changes that corresponded with other changes.
And in fact, yes, there could be all sorts of things like that. Plus, there are many changes in the molecule that wouldn't affect its immunological, its function as an antigen. So it's very, very crude. What's interesting is that this slightly pre-sequenced data actually does pretty well.
Yeah.
We'll see in a moment, we're going to reanalyze this by the other method.
That's what I was thinking, that it seems like it's cool that the data works.
It's amazing that it works. At the time, it was not easy, it was very expensive to get protein sequences. Nowadays, we just sequence the genes and translate, and we've got the protein sequences, so it becomes easy, but it was... I think I mentioned to you that the first myoglobin sequence, they had to do by buying a ton of sperm whale meat and grinding it up. That gives you some idea how much more tedious. Okay. The problem with UPGMA is this clockness assumption. It's a great method if you're willing to assume a clock. It's a great general. It's probably the most widely used, most robust overall method of hierarchical clustering. If you're a mathematical clusterer or somebody working to cluster voters or cluster, automobiles or cluster something else that isn't going to phylogeny. If you have a tree that has genuine differences of rate, it can lead to distortions. And here is a simple numerical example that I got in the book as well. Suppose I've got a tree. Here's the true rooted tree. Here are the true branch lengths. So it's 2 and 2 and 4 and 4. But then these two branches go, this one goes shooting up 13 and this shooting up 10. So they're at very different heights from the root. If we just read the distances off that, we magically know the true tree, and we read the distances off. So we assume we have some molecular method that's got a perfect estimate of the branch lengths between each pair of species. Here's the table. Now you do UPGMA. Well, you don't have to actually do anything very complicated. You just have to look at, you're going to start by picking the smallest distance, right? That's 12. That's between B and C. We'll tie them together at length 6. You are already in trouble because B and C were not a monophyletic group. And if you keep going on, it turns out you get a less than perfect fit with these branch lengths. A least squares fit would give you those branch lengths. And if you look at the two trees, you might say, well, if you're willing to say, I don't care where the root is, what about the topology of the tree as an unrooted tree? You'll see, as an unrooted tree, there's an internal branch that separates AB from CD. Here, the internal branch is here, separating AD from BC, which is not correct. So it's taking things that sort of didn't change very much and cluster it, tending to cluster them, whereas other changes, other lineages went shooting off. And when differences of rates in different lineages get up much bigger than a factor of 2, you start having this distortion. And the topology of the tree, even as an unrooted tree, is distorted by doing UPGMA under the delusion of clockness when there isn't really anything like a clock. Okay, well, are there methods like UPGMA, quick and dirty methods? Now, if you do, by the way, a least squares fit, which doesn't assume a clock, you get the right answer. You get a perfect fit to this tree in this idealized case. And so a least squares method won't fall into this trap, almost no matter how you weight it. Okay, now there is another method called neighbor joining that was invented by Saito and Ney in 1987 in the most cited paper in the phylogeny literature. At one point I looked a couple of years ago, it was like 30,000 citations. It's more now, they must be probably up above 40,000. Saito and Ney's paper, I hit the rolling wheel when I shouldn't have. Let me scroll back down there. Oh, I see, I'm going backwards. Why don't I? There we are. Okay. What they do is there's a whole algorithm, and it looks rather arbitrary. It says for each tip, you compute a quantity U sub I, which is basically the sum of all the weights to everybody else, divided not by the number of them, but by n minus, there are n minus one other things, by n minus two. That's deliberate and just happens to work. Then you subtract off from your distance table ui from column everything in column I and uj from everything in column, uj from everything in row j. You basically adjust the distances by subtracting the U's for the two things that are involved, then choose the smallest of those. Then you join the I and J, You compute the branch lengths this way, so they're not simply half the distance, but they're adjusted by these things. Then you compute the distance between the new node and the some other one, that each other one by this little formula. Then you do the same thing of dropping the I and J columns and rows and putting in a new row and column of, with these distances. So it's another one of these agglomerative clustering methods, but it has this funny adjustment for branch lengths involving computing these U sub I's. You keep going to get back to down to two nodes and then combine them. You may say, well, what quantity is that optimizing? And the answer is, there's a big literature in which people claim that it's sort of like minimum evolution or it's sort of like least squared, but it isn't either of them exactly. Here, it is these clustering methods, these agglomerative clustering methods, are building up a tree, not by adding things to the tree, but by starting out with a tree that looks like this, and then combining pairs successively. That's what we saw earlier called the star decomposition method. You keep combining things on the tree, and you keep doing that. So it's like this star decomposition method. Here is the neighbor joining tree on the Sarich data. I won't bore you with going through the computational details because they're more complex, as you can see. But the interesting thing it does is it does not make a clock-like tree. It puts seal and sea lion together with slightly unequal branch lengths. It puts bear and raccoon together with considerably bigger branch lengths from the raccoon side. Then instead of having weasel join next, dog joins, and that's believed to be biologically true. Then weasel comes in with a very small branch length there, and finally cat and monkey. So it actually gets you a biologically better tree, with some differences in branch lengths. By the way, this tree is really unrooted. The tree you get out is unrooted. It doesn't tell you where the root is. The last, you can make a placement of a root by sort of fudging, messing about and trying to get the tips kind of sort of level. And that's not a bad way, but I've drawn it here as a rooted tree. It's really making an unrooted tree. Now, we have the least squares methods. How do they look on the same data? And the answer is, if I use unweighted least squares, the Cavalli-Sforza and Edwards original least squares, what do I get? And the answer actually is the same tree topology. It looks different because there's some left-right flipping of cat and monkey and weasel, but it's the same topology. It brings bear and raccoon, then dog, then seal, sea lion, then weasel, then cat and monkey, but it's not the same branch lengths. They're a bit different. I'm just going to try to see. Let's see. Dog is sticking up more than raccoon, and bear is considerably shorter. Yeah, that's still true here. But if you actually, anyway, read off the branch lengths here, it's close to the neighbor joining tree, but it's not perfectly the same. The Fitch-Margoliash tree, which does that weighting, that inverse weighting to de-emphasize the large distances, also gets you the same tree topology, but now, for example, this internal branch that's separating the bear-raccoon clade from dog has gotten very short. Everything else, it's again, not the same as unweighted least squares and not the same as neighbor joining. But it's getting you the same topology. Here's the minimum evolution tree. Again, different from all the others. Again, the same topology. So they're all seeing the same signal. They're weighting things a little differently and getting the branch lengths a little differently. It is not guaranteed that on larger data sets they will always get the same topology. There's no theorem that guarantees that. So We have these distance matrix methods. They differ greatly in speed. The fastest of them is UPGMA, but then you have to assume clockness. The next fastest is neighbor joining. UPGMA can be done if you have a table of n things, so like 100 species, so n is 100. It can be done in time proportional to n squared. So it's polynomial time. Neighbor joining can be done polynomial time, naively proportionally to n cubed. Well, let's see. Let me think. No, I'm sorry. Let me back up. Neighbor joining, naively done, is proportional to n cubed. No. Back up again. UPGMA, when done, is UPGMA. Naively, if you just do the straightforward algorithm, proportional to n cubed. Cleverly, you can make it go n squared log n, which is much faster. Neighbor joining, naively n to the fourth, done cleverly, it's n cubed. I think it's n cubed semi-cleverly, and there is some sort of n to the like 2.5 log of something or other way of getting it even faster. But you have to do a huge amount of bookkeeping to do that.
What does that mean to be?
Number of species, number of tips.
Well, no, I mean, what's the difference between naively and cleverly?
An awful lot of, the program gets much bigger.
But I mean,
a lot of bookkeeping.
What are you changing?
Like, sorry?
What are you changing? Like how it weights?
It's not just how it weights, it's storing all kinds of intermediate stuff and then reusing it in ways that I don't even know or remember.
I see. Okay.
All I know is I saw those papers and I said, A, yes, how wonderful they got it faster. Boy, do I not want to think about how they did it. Because you go through the paper, there's just pages and pages of algebra to figure out how to do it. So it can be done. Because it is fast on large data sets, neighbor joining is very popular. It's the most popular distance matrix method. Okay, we're almost out of time. Where we're headed is to take the DNA models and make them more complicated and at least give you a taste of what's available there. And if I get the time, go on a little bit to how you cope with rate variation from site to site, which is real in molecular sequences. The one we'll start first with is Kimura's two-parameter model of 1980, which says, okay, not we won't do Jukes-Cantor. What we'll do is assume that transitions go at rate alpha, and transversions, which are the purple arrows, go at rate beta. And when you do that, the algebra gets a little more complicated, but you've got some better realism because the data is good. The model of evolution you'll be having will have more transitions than transversions by some factor. It's still symmetrical, top down and left right, so the equilibrium frequencies under this model are still 25% for each base. So in that sense, it's unreal. Then I'll go on beyond that and show you some models where the bases have unequal frequencies. We're going to kind of whiz through those models and say it can be shown that, because to save time, the detailed algebra, much of the detailed algebra is in the book. Anyway, we'll be getting there. Keep at it with your distances. I'll keep trying to get those last seven data sets fixed so that they too will work.